Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello and welcome to another Yale Journal of International Affairs podcast. I'm Rebecca Tucholsky. Today we'll be talking about North Korea, and in particular, the role of the U.S. and China on the nuclear issue. Our guests today are Mira Rapp-Hooper and Dingding Chen. Mira Rapp-Hooper is a senior research scholar at the Yale Law School, as well as a senior fellow in Yale's Paul Tsai China Center. She studies and writes on U.S.-China relations and national security issues in Asia. Dingding Chen is a professor of international relations at Jinan University in Guangzhou, China, and a non-resident fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin. He is also the founding director of Intellisia Institute, a newly established independent think tank focusing on international affairs in China. His research interests include Chinese foreign policy, Asia security, Chinese politics, and human rights. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's a pleasure to be here.
So happy to have you. So I want to start with getting a little bit of the lay of the land. This issue of uncertainty in North Korea has been cyclically dominating the news in this country lately. Earlier this week, the North Korean UN envoy implied that nuclear war may be on the brink. And just to get our cards on the table, what are some of the scenarios that we might see playing out between the DPRK, North Korean regime, and the Trump administration?
It's a great question, Rebecca, but I'm going to answer it by starting with backing up first.
Sure.
So just for our listeners who may be less familiar, and regardless, just to put everything in a little bit of context, it's pretty clear why there have been severely increased tensions between the United States and North Korea over the last few months. I think tensions are now the highest they've been since the end of the Korean War in 1953, and the proximate causes of that are as follows. North Korea, for all that, the fact that experts once upon a time believed that this would not be possible, has made a stunning technical sprint to a quite mature nuclear capability, which is now basically deliverable via ICBM, meaning with their nuclear weapons that are probably miniaturized and can fit on an operational ICBM, they can hold at risk the United States of America. The reason that these tensions have escalated further is, of course, because the United States has elected a president who himself has declared a goal of not allowing North Korea to obtain the very capability that it has obtained, and has taken a very bellicose set of rhetorical postures, at least when it comes to dealing with this issue. We've seen a war of words, so-called, over the last 2 months between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un himself is known for very bellicose rhetoric, but we've seen tensions heating up as the two leaders have volleyed these rhetorical bombs back and forth, threatening each other. Now, when we talk about the possible scenarios that could occur with the DPRK, they are, of course, many. However, it's worth noting that the situation on the Korean Peninsula did not just become dangerous this summer. North Korea's nuclear capability joined the world in 2006 when North Korea first tested a nuclear weapon. It has been developing short, medium, and intermediate range missiles for the better part of two decades at this point. So North Korea's neighbors, with the exception of the United States, have felt its threat for a very long time. And short of the nuclear domain, of course, there has been the potential threat of a resumption of the Korean War ever since it ended in 1953. So North Korea has held at risk South Korea through the use of many thousands of artillery tubes that are arrayed along the DMZ, and there has been the potential threat of the resumption of conflict ever since that time. So this problem has come to a crest this summer, but it is very long in making. Now, when it comes to the potential scenarios that could occur in the future, of course, the administration in the U.S. appears to be taking a very hard line. It is possible that Donald Trump would authorize a first use of American force against North Korea. There's no question that his advisors are at least considering options to that effect. However, it's worth noting that because of what I mentioned, because of the conventional threat in North Korea against the South, and because of the shorter range missiles that North Korea already possesses, any U.S. military action against North Korea would be highly destructive. There is no way to guarantee that North Korea would be prevented from retaliating. And if it retaliated, that retaliation would come likely either against South Korea or perhaps even more likely against Japan, both of whom are U.S. treaty allies longstanding. So there's a good chance that the U.S. administration will look at the casualty numbers that would be implicated by those sorts of plans and conclude they simply cannot take that type of catastrophic action. Other scenarios involve the increased use of financial measures, that is sanctions, to try to get North Korea to change its calculus. That would include continuing to cut off the North Korean economy. There's sort of a myth that North Korea is the most sanctioned country in the history of the world, but that's not entirely true. And there is more that can be done to put pressure on North Korea's economy. This administration will probably consider, and this is something that Ding Ding and I should talk about, the use of secondary financial measures, meaning financial measures against Chinese companies, entities, and individuals that continue to do business with North Korea. And a third, but not mutually exclusive possibility, is the fact that the Trump administration may very well be willing to negotiate with Kim Jong-un before too long. I don't see that happening in the coming months, but I think paradoxically, for all that Trump has been very bellicose in his rhetoric, he lacks the sort of normal constraints that act on U.S. presidents when they think about negotiating with repugnant dictators. I think a typical U.S. president would be very hesitant about legitimizing Kim Jong-un in meeting with him, about legitimizing Kim Jong-un's nuclear weapons capability. But Trump may not have those compunctions. And if he thinks he can get some kind of a, quote, deal to settle the North Korean nuclear issue, he may just be inclined to sit down at a negotiating table. But I'm curious to hear what my colleague thinks.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's a very good question, and I very much agree with what Mira has just said about this issue. It is a very complicated issue, partly because it's an old issue. It's been around for several decades, and because it's the consequences of this problem or development can be very huge. So all countries involved in these issues, including U.S., China, Russia, Japan, South Korea, must be very, very careful with their actions. And if you ask us what are the possible scenarios, I think there are at least three possible scenarios, very broadly speaking. First of all, we could have some kind of war, so to speak, meaning we could have some serious military conflict. You know, like Mira has just mentioned, rhetorics from both sides in recent months have been quite tense, and they could lead to at least some sort of miscalculation from all sides, and therefore you could have some sort of unwanted conflict, military conflict in the coming months or year. And the second more positive scenario or outcome is some sort of negotiation between North Korea and other major players, including U.S., China, and others. And like Mira has, you know, just mentioned, President Trump will make his first Asia trip in early November, and he will visit Japan and South Korea, and possibly he would even visit the DMZ, demilitarized zone.
Let's hope not.
Right. It's a security concern, but I'm sure he's considering all these options that might, give a signal to North Koreans that this president or this administration is at least willing to think about some sort of face-to-face exchanges or even formal negotiations. So that's that cannot be ruled out completely at this stage. And of course, the third scenario is somewhere in between. We don't get a military conflict, and at the same time, we don't get negotiation, but we have some sort of tensions increasing in between now and the next 6 months. And I think this is probably the most likely scenario because neither side is at this moment willing or able to sit down and negotiate calmly with the other side. And because of domestic politics, because of the changing international situations, so on and so forth, like Mira and I also agree that this is a very complicated issue. It's been around for some time, some years already, so we should not expect a quick solution to this problem. And also because North Korea is making all these aggressive developments in terms of missile technology, so on and so forth, so that's a big variable because that would change all the calculations on all sides. So I think we should be prepared to accept the third scenario for some time. Then we'll see what would happen for the other two scenarios.
you've both laid out such detail on so I want to probe you on so many aspects of what you've just said. But let's start with negotiations, in part because we're coming off of a week where another nuclear negotiation has been hot off the press in Iran. And so I wanted to ask, why hasn't something like that, some kind of negotiation with the authorities in the DPRK, happened already?
So it's a good question, Rebecca, and the negotiating history with the DPRK is a nasty one. It's worth noting that for all that I think many observers in the United States and around the world are critical of Donald Trump's handling of the North Korea nuclear situation, it is not his fault. There is plenty of blame to go around both in the United States and in China when it comes to the mishandling of North Korea's nuclear weapons capability. And several administrations in the United States have tried and failed to negotiate with the DPRK. So the North Korean nuclear issue really first came to a crest in the United States in 1993, 1994 in the Clinton administration when we observed North Korea getting ready to unload its plutonium reactor in a way that would allow it to move towards a nuclear weapons capability. The United States at that time considered the use of military force to try to stop North Korea and instead ended up concluding a negotiated agreement called the Agreed Framework, which lasted for pretty much the rest of the Clinton administration. There was some bad behavior on North Korea's part. There was some failure on the United States' part to live up to its obligations. But that agreed framework basically kept the program in the box for a better part of 6 years. That negotiated framework was discontinued in the Bush administration. And during the Bush administration, we had the so-called six-party talks, which involved North Korea, the United States, China, South Korea, Japan, and Russia. There was some progress made through the six-party talks, but ultimately they collapsed. And I would say that the United States really took its eye off the ball on the North Korean nuclear question because of the war in Iraq. We sort of lumped North Korea in with the axis of evil and then went ahead and paid attention to the other parts of that axis. And in the process, North Korea went ahead and tested its first nuclear weapon. It withdrew from the NPT. And it is worth noting that once a country crosses the nuclear threshold and has withdrawn itself from its nonproliferation obligations internationally, it becomes very difficult to roll back that progress, which is exactly why you saw the Obama administration prioritize the Iran nuclear agreement over the denuclearization of North Korea, because it is a lot easier to keep a country from going nuclear in the first place than it is to try to roll back the capabilities of a country who already has them. We have precisely one case in recorded nuclear history of a country that has an assembled nuclear arsenal willfully giving it up when it belongs to that country. That case is South Africa, and it gave up its nuclear weapons because it was transitioning from an apartheid regime to a free government. And basically, the apartheid regime did not want to pass off nuclear weapons. So with North Korea's emergence as a nuclear-capable state, it became way harder to try to take those capabilities away. Essentially, at that point, North Korea had every incentive in the world to try to keep developing its capabilities to strengthen a potential role at a bargaining table. But more likely, we believe that North Korea actually has been determined to acquire those capabilities the whole time because it sees them as key to its regime survival. The North Korean regime is isolated. It obviously fears the South Korean military presence on its border. It fears the American military presence on its border. The North Korean relationship with China is less strong than it has been in the past. And nuclear weapons are good for nothing if not guaranteed regime survival. So as it has continued to develop that capability, the odds have shifted more and more against the United States and any of its negotiating partners that we were going to be able to get North Korea to the table at all. Again, I think there's plenty of blame to pass around in the Obama administration, too. I think they could have done more, particularly by way of sanctions to try to induce North Korea to the table. But again, this issue did not emerge this year. We have had many bites at this apple. A couple of them went okay. Many of them were failures. But once the capability was out of the box, it was always going to be very difficult to put back in.
Yes, again, I very much agree with Mira on this point, because a successful negotiation would at least require several factors, I believe. First of all, you need a willingness on the part of those sides to actually sit down and then negotiate on this issue. But currently, I don't think North Korea is actually quite willing to sit down because they believe they can make very quick developments, success, you know, progress in nuclear technology, and that would change the whole calculation, you know, by other sides. So they would actually gain a better deal, so to speak, when they actually wanted to negotiate with the U.S. and the other powers. So they try to gain some advantages before they really seriously think about negotiation. So that's one changing variable. And also because on the other side, the U.S. or Russia or China are not sure about what the possible achievements could be made this time, because as we have heard from Mira, in the 1990s, we almost reached a deal with North Korea, but for all sorts of unforeseen reasons, the deal did not really go through. And again, I agree with you, there lots of lots of blame to go around here. And so each country, I would say, has its own different motivations and thinking in the domestic politics. So it's very hard for more than three actors to sit down and negotiate a very successful plan. The Iran deal can be, I think, theoretically a good example, but like you said, given what technologies North Korea now possesses and the future achievements North Korea would likely make, I don't think they are very interested in giving up its current nuclear program or weapons, whatever. So they will try to develop more nuclear weapons and see what what positions they can, what kind of advantageous positions they can be in future negotiations. And I think also there's also collective action problem, as we all know. China and the U.S. do not necessarily see eye to eye on this issue. They have different domestic preferences, different domestic politics calculations, and I think North Korea has been, in a way, smartly exploiting this sort of differences or mistrust between China and U.S. to gain some, breathing room for its nuclear program, and that needs to be solved first if we want to see some serious and a successful negotiation on this issue.
I think that's a great point to transition a little bit to talk about those domestic politics in China. What are the priorities of the current Chinese policy towards North Korea?
Well, for quite a long time, Chinese government has made it very clear that they want three things on, related to North Korea nuclear issue. First of all, the Chinese government wants to see stability on the Korean Peninsula. That's the top number one priority, because China understands it's very important for China's own domestic development, whether it's economic or social or political, and that we China needs to have a stable international environment here, meaning Korean Peninsula. And the second priority for Chinese government is non-proliferation or no nuclear weapons. But things like we just mentioned, North Korea pretty much now possesses operationable nuclear weapons, and that's probably very difficult to achieve in the short run. But still, I think theoretically, it is possible to, through some nice combination of carrots and the sticks, North Korea theoretically, again, could be persuaded to give up its nuclear programs in the future, theoretically. And China wants that as number two. And thirdly, China would like to see a more stable Korean peninsula between North Korea and South Korea. And so if eventually they move to reunification in the future, China wants that to move smoothly and gradually. And so those three priorities, I think, are a little bit maybe different from the U.S. priorities. So that, I think, is one important domestic politics factor hindering the process.
I think Ding Ding is absolutely right. I think it's useful to note that U.S. and Chinese priorities are not diametrically opposed, but they're not aligned. And where they're close to aligned, they're not aligned in their intensity or their magnitude. So Ding Ding just gave us a list of three priorities for China. The United States priority number one has been the full denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So unlike China, that has a long history of ties with North Korea that have become increasingly complicated, but nonetheless, a long history, including an alliance agreement in the early 1960s, long historical ties, China shares a border with North Korea. So when Ding Ding talks of a stable Korean Peninsula, what he's intimating is that China does not want to see the regime collapse and millions of North Korean refugees spill over the northern border with China. It would also become incumbent upon China to secure or help secure the weapons of mass destruction in North Korea and to possibly deal with an insurgency or a military coup that could result as from this regime collapse. So these are all possible futures that make China very nervous. The United States, for its part, is thousands of miles away from North Korea, has a longstanding and very firm alliance guarantee with South Korea and Japan, has always thought of North Korea as a diametrically opposed adversary. So the relationship between the United States and between the United States and North Korea is a little bit more clear-cut. We want to get the nuclear weapons out of their hands first and foremost. Also, when it comes to this reunification issue, part of China's concern is that if it puts too much pressure on North Korea, not only will it have to deal with all of the horrible consequences I just mentioned with respect to potential regime collapse, but that the Korean Peninsula could be reunified under control of the South, meaning Seoul essentially becomes the capital of all of Korea, and the United States maintains a significant military presence on the Korean Peninsula. If, for example, the 30,000 troops that are currently arrayed along the DMZ pushed up to the northern border, that would be a significant security concern for China, that it had tens of thousands of American troops now on its border. So while both countries would theoretically love to see North Korea without nuclear weapons, the concerns are not the same. Those largely derive from history and proximity to the threat, as well as different priorities and thinking about how the end of a North Korean regime might ensue.
So speaking of China's priorities and how they are aligned in some ways with the U.S., what kinds of leverage have they been willing to use so far, and what kinds of leverage do they have that they haven't been willing to use?
I'll take that first, and then I'll kick it over to Ding Ding, because I think he'll have more to say in particular about maybe current domestic politics. I would sort of distinguish between the questions of influence and leverage, right? Because we're often told that because the relationship between North Korea and China isn't as good as it was before, China has a much less influence over North Korea. The reality is that China, because North Korea is so isolated, continues to support 80 to 90% of the North Korean economy. So there is quite a bit of economic leverage that the Chinese continue to retain when it comes to the North Korean economy, should they choose to use it. When the United States thinks about potentially leveling additional secondary sanctions against Chinese entities or individuals, it is because U.S. policymakers are thinking about the fact that China is so key to North Korea's economic health. So by putting additional sanctions on China, the theory goes, China might sort of reevaluate its cost-benefit analysis on North Korea, put the pressure on North Korea and the financial sector a little bit more, and North Korea might in turn become more willing to negotiate as a result. That is one theory of the case of how Chinese leverage could be used. Now, before I turn it over to Ding Ding, I'll say that it's worth noting that part of the reason why that leverage hasn't been used fully in the past is exactly because of the scenarios on the Korean Peninsula we were just discussing. Much as China would like to see North Korea not possess nuclear weapons, we also know that priority number one, first and foremost, is stability on the Korean Peninsula. So if China were to completely turn off the spigot, or largely turn off the spigot on the North Korean economy, its leaders worry that it will not just result in North Korea coming to the negotiating table, but that it will turn off that spigot so hard that the entire regime will collapse and the peninsula will be destabilized. So part of the reason we have seen China apply what I would call incremental leverage, but not revolutionary leverage in the last several years, is because it is worried that it won't be possible to hit that sort of perfect zone where it both induces North Korea to negotiate, but does not cause the regime to collapse.
Well, exactly. I think the first part of the question is, does China still retain some sort of influence over North Korea? Yes, of course, China has influence over North Korea. And what kind of leverage would China use to pressure North Korea to stop its nuclear programs? I think for the last year, China has been supportive of a series of UN sanctions on North Korea. That proves that China is willing to put some pressure on North Korea in order to stop its nuclear programs. Nonetheless, the Chinese concern is twofold. First of all, how much pressure should we, if we could, apply on North Korea so that North Korea would stop its nuclear programs without collapsing? So we don't know exactly how much pressure is, like you said, a perfect pressure. So that's the first difficult issue that we all needed to solve. And the second issue is, even if you put a lot of pressure on North Korea, we are not sure about what kind of response North Korea would actually initiate, because there are two possible scenarios. One, North Korea would comply with pressure and come back to negotiation table, or North Korea could simply become desperate and even launch attack, a strike on South Korea, or even U.S. troops in South Korea or Japanese territory. That would be a disaster for all sides involved in this. So we are not completely sure about the internal calculation within North Korea, especially with this young leader, Kim Jong-un, which is very, very difficult to understand from outside point of view. So the Chinese thinking is this, we wanted to put some pressure on North Korea, but we are not sure about the consequences of this approach. So we wanted to take it very carefully, gradually, and see what would happen in the process, and then decide to make the next moves.
You keep talking about the concern about regime stability, and in particular how hard it is to know anything at all about the internal workings of the North Korean regime. What do we know, and what can we expect to be kind of any kind of tipping point for this regime?
Well, I think we do know one thing, which is quite common to all nation states in international politics, that is that a nation state seeks survival, regime survival. So North Korea is no exception in this. And whether the young leader himself is rational or irrational, that's a different matter. I think as a state, North Korea seeks regime survival, and that's the number one priority for North Korea for many, many decades already. And we also know that the regime itself, despite all these criticisms from outside perspective, the regime itself is actually enjoying some sort of support domestically. Could be unwilling support, could be willing support. Either way, it has some degree of support. So it's probably unrealistic to expect North Korea to simply implode from within anytime soon. So we need to be a little bit more realistic and patient about the regime, surviving for some time to come. And that means we need to come up with a collective proposal or solution to solve this problem. And besides that, because of information, the lack of information, the lack of intelligence, we really are in a very difficult position to understand the details of the regime. And outside commentators and analysts have always been surprised by the new, personnel movements within North Korea, just like the recent cases show that Kim Jong-un's younger sister is now in a very important position in the Politburo, and that has been unknown for many outside analysts. So that's a surprising part, which shows you that because maybe the lack of interactions between North Korea and the outside world, even including China. China does not know the detailed inner workings of North Korea government regime. So that adds just some more difficulties for us to come up with a solution.
It's worth noting, just picking up on Ding Ding's last point, that the United States has long had an intelligence problem with the inner workings of the North Korean regime. China has generally had more privileged information because of the nature of the relationship. But part of the way that Kim Jong-un, as opposed to his father and grandfather before him, has consolidated power is to execute anyone who he considers to be an enemy of his regime. And that has largely included the high-level figures in the North Korean government who had ties to Beijing. So this has become a more difficult intelligence target for China because of his systematic purges of the North Korean government. I'll elaborate a bit on Ding Ding's point about North Korea's objectives, which I largely agree with. I think number one, first and foremost, regime survival. And as I mentioned before, nuclear weapons are a great way to try to ensure regime survival for many states. I think Kim Jong-un is a young guy. He's 33 years old. That's my age. And he plans to die in his bed at a ripe old age. He believes that he will rule this country for a very long time. So his pursuit of nuclear weapons is largely with that as an objective. Objective number two that we have heard certainly from past attempts to negotiate with North Korea is that North Korea would like to be accepted as a nuclear state. Mm-hmm. There is an objective to have the United States, China, other powers in the region recognize this capability as a real threat and something that confers power on North Korea. It may seem sort of ridiculous to conceive of, but North Korea, as far as we know, would very much like to end up in a place like Pakistan. Essentially, a country who, while censured for having developed nuclear weapons, has been allowed to sort of go about its business, provide for its security in whatever way it desires, and also pursue growth in its economy as a result. So we do believe that Kim Jong-un would also like to perhaps come to a negotiating table for the purposes of having legitimacy conferred on him in that way. We also know that perhaps a tertiary goal is that he would like to undermine U.S. alliances in the region because he feels that they threaten his survival. So that's related to goal number one, but it's not entirely the same. I think we've seen him actually do a pretty deft job at that in these last few months as he has been engaging in this war of words with Donald Trump. He has exploited the fact that Trump and President Moon, the new president of South Korea, do not have great relations with one another. He has threatened Japan in a way that makes it obvious that the United States is not going to be able to defend Japan against literally every scenario. So when he tests missiles that overfly Japan, he's demonstrating to Tokyo that the United States cannot save you from everything. And by developing an ICBM, he is trying to accomplish something that the Soviet Union accomplished during the Cold War, which is a phenomenon that strategists like to call decoupling. It's a situation where because an adversary can hold the United States at risk, they raise for us the costs of intervening in a conflict on behalf of an ally. So before North Korea had an ICBM, we could enter a war on South Korea or Japan's behalf without worrying that we would face retaliation against our own homeland. Under the threat of an ICBM, the U.S. military and civilian decision makers necessarily have to pause to think, is it worth intervening in this conflict? And might the United States of America become victim of a nuclear attack if we do? So the ICBM itself is a strategy for trying to put a wedge into America's alliances to try to guarantee this broader goal of survival that Kim Jong-un is so interested in.
And another motivation of North Korea, I would simply add, is actually it would be kind of difficult to understand from our perspective, is reunification with South Korea. Because usually when people talk about the reunification between the North and the South, people would think of South Korea dominating North Korea. But from the North Koreans' perspective, they are actually in a quite good position to achieve reunification under the leadership of North Korea and presumably the young leader Kim Jong-un. So that's why they wanted to have like a sort of a three-stage plan. First of all, they would guarantee a regime survival with the development of nuclear weapons. And the second stage, they would achieve international recognition or legitimacy you know, recognition by major powers, including U.S., Russia, China, so on and so forth. And finally, they would achieve reunification because they see themselves as a middle power or even a major power in Asia. And they could do this, theoretically, with their economic development and nuclear development and ideological development, so on and so forth. So it's hard for us to understand their motivations, but I think from their perspective, this is also a very important motivation.
At the very least, it remains an important narrative in North Korea. I would sort of add the caveat that, of course, if we know that Kim Jong-un wants to survive and U.S. troops remain on the Korean Peninsula and we retain a mutual security guarantee with South Korea, the United States military would enter a second Korean War if it was started by the North. So Kim Jong-un, I do not believe, will prioritize reunification of the peninsula over regime survival, but he may be playing a very long game trying to shift the balance of power on the Korean Peninsula in his favor.
So in that scenario where North Korea makes the first military move, what is the threshold for that happening? And do you think that there would be a scenario in which South Korea or the United States were to make the first move?
So North Korea has, since the end of the Korean War, engaged in a number of relatively lower level provocations. I don't mean to diminish them in severity. People have lost their lives. They sunk a Chonan military corvette vessel in 2010. The same year, there was a shelling of some offshore islands called Yongpyeongdo, in which four South Koreans died. These are all we call them provocations because they don't rise to the level of a full-on military assault, but they may impose some military costs on South Korea. They have not escalated in ways that would provoke a full-scale conventional conflict. We generally think of a conflict starting if North Korea started it, either using the artillery it has on the DMZ against Seoul or threatening or trying to hold at risk a U.S. ally, perhaps threatening them with nuclear weapons. And in the case that a conflict broke out at North Korea's initiation, I think there's really no doubt that the United States would be involved on South Korea's behalf. Part of the reason the United States has left 30,000 troops on the peninsula since the end of the Korean War is precisely to act as a tripwire and to send the signal to North Korea that you cannot invade the South without also triggering a war with the United States. It's worth noting that the United States and South Korea are the only alliance besides NATO in which the United States has a unified military command with an ally, which means that their training occurs in lockstep. They have shared military commanders. There is an incredible level of military integration here. The United States has taken extraordinary efforts over the course of the last 60 years to be able to demonstrate that our military fate cannot be disentangled from the South Korean military fate. So that's the sort of situation in which North Korea provokes a war. It is possible that the United States could decide to launch a first strike against North Korea's military facilities and in particular its nuclear facilities. In those cases, I imagine they would be exploring options that are intended to level the nuclear complex and missile facilities. However, at this point, it is believed that North Korea could have anywhere from 24 to 60 nuclear warheads, has scores of missiles, and most of its most valuable assets are stored in hardened caves. So this would be a highly risky operation that would have a large likelihood of retaliation by North Korea and no guarantee that it would successfully eliminate North Korea's capability. And of course, we can anticipate that if the United States did attack North Korea to try to eliminate its nuclear capability, you can't bomb away knowledge. So North Korea would restart that program and would be armed again in some time. Published casualty estimates for a all-out war on the Korean Peninsula include as many as 1 million deaths in the first week of conflict. Most of those deaths are Korean deaths, It's worth noting just for everyone here at home that not only are there 30,000 American troops on the DMZ, there are 120,000 American civilians who live in the Seoul metropolitan area. There are many, many thousands of Chinese who also live in the Seoul metropolitan area. So this would be a conflict on a scale so horrific that we have not seen it since World War II. That is what engenders my belief that ultimately no leader is likely to make an affirmative decision to seek this conflict. And I believe that that's true of North Korea, too. As Ding Ding signaled earlier, I do believe that Kim Jong-un is a rational actor. That doesn't mean that he's a good guy. That doesn't mean that we like him. What that means is a technical matter is that we believe he's able to couple means and ends and provide for his own self-interest. I believe that he's able to make these calculations that we just laid out here about the number of deaths that would ensue, about the likelihood that an attack on South Korea would end his regime, and that ultimately he will not do that. But we also have to think, as Ding Ding signaled earlier, about the potential that there could be some kind of accident or inadvertent escalation between North Korea and the United States. That would occur if perhaps this war of words continues and then there is some kind of clash between aircraft or skirmish along the DMZ, where there is an accidental exchange of military force that spirals into something bigger. So just because I do believe that deterrence will generally prevail on the Korean Peninsula, that does not mean that there is no risk of some kind of accident that could spark a war that nobody wanted. Indeed, I think this escalating rhetoric makes it more likely that that could happen.
Exactly. I very much agree with that. The thing I worry about the most is the kind of miscalculation on both sides about the crisis. And particularly under normal conditions, I don't think either North Korea or the U.S. would strike first. They would only strike first if they are 100% sure that the other side is already launching a strike or attack. Then you have to respond before it's too late. So that's the only precondition that I can think of that would lead to very serious military conflict. But we know as human beings, as policymakers, we are usually rational, but we sometimes let emotions or other mysterious factors, you know, get in the way of our decision-making process. So we can never really rule out emotions and therefore miscalculation. And when that happens and, you know, the worst outcome is one side, either the U.S. or North Korea, would make very rash decisions in response. And accidents by low-level military officials or some other policymakers could lead to some kind of military incidents. And then the other side would have to respond with force. And that's this kind of a vicious cycle that, you know, we don't want to see happening. But theoretically, it is a possibility. And I think that's why it's important to calm down and do not, as we say in China, put liquor into fire and ratcheting up the rhetorics toward each other, that would only make things more complicated and difficult to resolve.
I'd like to add two quick details to what Ding Ding just said, and I think he's absolutely on point with these remarks. First, he mentioned the fact that while leaders are mostly rational, and you know, we do generally tend to believe that Kim Jong-un is rational, that things like cognitive biases or misperceptions could interfere in decision-making calculus. And that's absolutely right. In the case of North Korea, that's exacerbated on all sides by the fact that we are not in communication with each other and we know relatively little about one another. So as opposed to, let's say, another adversary like Iran, who we don't love, but who we've been negotiating with recently, right? And we have some amount of communication. Or Russia, who we maintain diplomatic ties with, despite the fact that we sometimes believe they're up to no good. The North Koreans have almost nothing to rely on in U.S. foreign policy besides the statements that are coming out of our high-level government officials. And we're in the same position. We are looking at official statements that come out of North Korea. We are looking at the words of Kim Jong-un, and we are interpreting that as the sole determinants of policy. And they're doing the same for us. So even if you don't believe that anything can come from a diplomatic deal with North Korea, and I am skeptical about a deal happening right now, there's something worthwhile about engaging solely for the purposes of reducing that risk of miscalculation that could cause conflict. The second thing that I would note is that when it comes to Kim Jong-un and his strategic posture, he is in a position which makes this escalating war of words the more worrisome still. We know that he hopes to survive. We know that he has acquired nuclear weapons because he is conventionally inferior to South Korea and the United States of America. We know that he still has relatively few nuclear weapons compared to a major power. So he is in a position of what we in the strategic community like to call use it or lose it. He does not get to use his nuclear weapons second. He can only use them first, meaning because there are relatively few and because if we, the United States, had the opportunity to take them out in a military conflict, there is a decent chance we could do significant damage to that complex. If he anticipates that a conflict is coming, he may believe there is pressure on him to use force first. And that's really worrisome. Obviously, as we already mentioned, we think that both leaders will step away from the brink, but these dynamics can't be emphasized enough. He essentially has incentives, both in terms of his potential misperceptions and cognitive biases and the material way that his weapons are postured vis-a-vis a stronger adversary, to lean forward in a situation that seems dangerous and destabilizing rather than to lean back and be more cautious.
So given the limited intelligence that the U.S. government has in North Korea, and given that you said already that these weapons are in very sheltered bunkers, how likely is it that the U.S. would be able to take out every single nuclear weapon in a first strike?
Extraordinarily unlikely. We've, as you mentioned, discussed intelligence. It is different to have, terrain intelligence than it is to have human intelligence. I think we do have a pretty good visual picture of North Korea. But at this point, with several dozen nuclear weapons, there is very little chance that the U.S. intelligence community knows where all several dozen of them are located. Many of North Korea's missiles are now mobile, which means that they may not all be stored in the same place. They could be moved around from day to day. And if North Korea anticipates any kind of attack, they can be moved around quite quickly. And then the additional consideration, of course, is that even if somehow the United States were to be able to completely take out all of the nuclear weapons, there is still the possibility of significant conventional retaliation. So with 10,000 artillery tubes arrayed along the DMZ, even if the United States was able to put a significant dent in this nuclear program, it would have to worry about the hundreds of thousands of lives that were held at risk at the end of those artillery tubes, even when that operation was done. It's worth noting that the Trump administration is considering military options right now. Every president since President Clinton in the United States has considered military options. On both sides of the aisle, right? Both parties have considered this. And all three presidents who've looked at those options in the past have decided that they're not really options because of the catastrophic toll that would come along with them.
I would simply add that even if the U.S. is capable of taking out all the nuclear weapons in North Korea, the U.S. probably wouldn't do it. For reason number one, North Korea is still quite a strong and conventional military power. It has capabilities to retaliate against U.S. and South Korea and also Japan and others. And also because the humanitarian costs of that kind of action are simply too huge to handle by the neighboring countries or the international community. So that's why I think the U.S., the previous administrations from both parties have been cautious, even though they have always have had contingency plans. I think every country does have that. So I think this is not only this is not just a military, tactical problem. It's also humanitarian and the political issue. That's why I think we need more caution. We need more rational thinking in this process.
So last month, Defense Secretary Mattis suggested that there might be a military option that would not put Seoul at risk. Do we know what that is, and is it really a viable option?
Yeah, that's a great question. Many of us in the community were totally perplexed by what he was getting at the time. Since then, President Trump has come out to articulate his belief that the United States possesses missile defense, which is 97% accurate. That's the closest to that we've been able to get to sort of some kind of logic that might have led Mattis to proclaim that the United States had an option. But it's still perplexing because the United States does not possess ballistic missile defense that's 97% effective. The United States has two different types of missile defense, what we call theater or area defenses that are stationed in the region. Those are systems that usually get referred to by the names THAAD or the SM-3 or SM-6 Aegis systems. Missile defense, we can come back to this, is a bit of a bone of contention in the U.S.-China relationship. But the United States also possesses ground-based missile defenses that are located on the western coast of the United States. The president appears to believe that those ground-based missile defenses in the United States are 97% accurate, when in fact their testing record is approximately 50% accurate. I think we're hard-pressed to argue that it would be worth flipping a coin on whether the United States of America is willing to be struck by a nuclear weapon to rely on that missile defense capability. The missile defenses that are stationed in Asia are quite a bit more effective, but they are intended to intercept medium or intermediate range ballistic missiles. They intercept them at shorter range, and they're intended to protect specific areas. So the missile defenses that are deployed in South Korea, for example, are really intended to protect South Korean and U.S. troops. In South Korea. Likewise, they protect major Japanese military installations and bases in Japan. So best guess maybe that Mattis was referring to something that relies on missile defense to kind of mop up any North Korean potential residue, but I think many of us are uncomfortable with the idea of relying on that. It is possible that he also could have been gesturing at some other operation entirely, let's say what we might call a left of launch intrusion into North Korea's capabilities, meaning some kind of cyber or other electronic interference in the program. He also could have been talking about some kind of decapitation strike in which the United States attempted to take out Kim Jong-un and hoped that the North Koreans who remain would not retaliate absent their leader. But it's hard to know exactly. Again, the best guess has been this missile defense theory, but I find it hard to believe that Secretary Mattis believes that ballistic missile defense is 97% accurate, even if the president appears to.
Yeah, I think that's also a very interesting puzzle to me. I think the real issue is even if the U.S. can find a way to save Seoul in the case of a North Korean attack, the risk is you are not 100% sure. So you always worry about that even 1% possibility that you might get attacked from North Korea. And because the humanitarian cost will be simply too high for you to accept. So even if you have, you know, so much confidence in that, are you willing to try that risk? I think that's a very difficult question for the policymakers to think about. So
I would also note that there's a significant alliance management component to what Mattis's statements were probably aiming at. If Mattis had, so he was asked this question by a reporter, mm-hmm. right? If Mattis had said no, the United States has no military options that don't hold Seoul at risk, that's like saying to South Korea, we cannot protect you, right? Or we are not intending to consider options in this space. That sort of debunks the notion that America is considering serious military options, right? He also may have been responding in part to the fact that President Trump and President Moon in South Korea, as I signaled before, do not have a particularly strong relationship. And President Moon has really dug in his heels in the face of Trump's rhetoric and made clear that South Korea does not want to be dragged into a war on the United States' behalf in this situation. So Mattis may have also been doing some alliance management with this quick off-the-cuff statement, essentially trying to keep America's ally in South Korea reasonably assured while not driving a wedge any further between the United States and South Korea, given the interpersonal dynamics of those leaders.
So you've laid out just a whole slew of options: military, sanctions, negotiations, and so forth. I want to ask each of you from the perspective of your home country, what is the best option on the table for the United States and for China in this regard?
Well, I would say the best outcome or available approach for China is continued sanctions. That's a way, considering all other options, to weaken North Korea's economy and its capabilities to reach a full nuclear status before we can think of a realistic solution. And because all other options, either military or negotiations at the current stage, are not mature. So continued sanctions, I believe, would continue for some time. And in the meantime, we just needed to find narrow our differences between different players and really come up with a realistic and good proposal.
I'll pick up on that call to be realistic and say that I think any realistic U.S. or Chinese strategy starts with an acknowledgement that we are not taking these nuclear weapons away. I do not know an observer of North Korea who believes that Kim Jong-un is going to give up his nuclear weapons. So to my mind, with that understood, the United States can formulate objectives and strategies to try to limit the potential scope of his reach and ensure that the region remains relatively safe and stable in the face of that capability. To my mind, that includes a strategy that relies, number one, on containment, meaning preventing Kim Jong-un from exporting nuclear weapons, nuclear or missile technologies to other bad actors. We know that North Korea has already shared nuclear technology with Syria. So this is not a theoretical question of will they do it, but it is when they will try to do it again. And otherwise trying to keep our arms around the military reach of this regime. Containment, I do believe, also continues to include sanctions, as Ding Ding indicated, so that the North Koreans are limited in the amount of cash and other aspects of their economy that they're able to devote to their military programs. Number two is deterrence, which means continued reliance on alliances, on military presence in the region, on missile defense, and also on statements, on really clear, careful public statements in the United States and in China that signal to Kim Jong-un what will happen if he takes bad actions, but also signal to him that his future is not in jeopardy if he does not take those bad actions. So really carefully formulated threats that also come with escape routes are an essential component of deterrence. I already mentioned the importance of focusing on nuclear nonproliferation, but I can't say that enough. I think that is going to be a central concern in the coming years. And then the final aspect that I'll add to this is that eventually I do think we will all, I hope, end up back at a negotiating table talking about some form of arms control. There is no history of negotiating with a nuclear power who has exited the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and developed nuclear weapons to place limits on those programs. But when it comes to containing the reach of North Korea's programs, basically the way we can do that is through arms control. I don't think we have a reason to believe that Kim Jong-un is willing to agree to limits right now because he's still developing and perfecting those capabilities. But eventually what we would seek from him is something to the effect of capping the numbers of nuclear warheads he's allowed to possess, capping the types of nuclear weapons he's allowed to possess, so preventing him from developing uranium weapons, given that he already has plutonium weapons, ideally limiting the megatonnage of weapons that he's allowed to develop, putting limits on the number of delivery vehicles that he is able to possess, and then actually getting North Korea to enter into non-proliferation agreements of its own. So that is a sort of very lofty objective at this point when things are in such a tense spot. I don't think it will come anytime soon. But when it comes to what objectives of an eventual negotiation with North Korea should look like, I think we have entered the world of arms control. And in a few years, that could have a role to play so long as it comes alongside a serious containment strategy and a serious deterrence strategy. In the United States, we often treat containment and deterrence as though they're sort of unsavory fallback options, but it's worth noting that containment and deterrence was the way we dealt with the Soviet Union for the entire Cold War. They take a lot of strategic thought to implement, a lot of diplomatic and political and military energy to implement, and these are strategies that we have used for handling adversaries for a long time. Deterrence has prevailed on the Korean Peninsula since 1953, and in all likelihood, it will continue to do so.
Thank you so much, both of you. I could talk to you both forever about this. This is fascinating to hear you both talk and the perspective that you bring. But unfortunately, I think we're out of time. So is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up here?
Well, I would simply say we needed to be more patient. We needed to be calm about this whole situation. I think Mira mentioned that perfectly. It's probably time for us to think about containment strategy instead of thinking of, you know, the so-called total solution to this problem. And I think that's a very important point we should keep in mind.
And I'll just redouble my call for strategy amongst all parties, and the U.S. and China in particular. I think we have seen in the last few months the danger that we can do with words when they are not carefully chosen and carefully deployed. But we can also send very strong signals, even to adversaries, about whom we know little and who are pursuing dangerous capabilities when we choose our words wisely. These pieces of advice may be falling on deaf ears with respect to the White House right now, but I do hope that American strategists and Chinese strategists alike will do some work to think about how they can use strategy and international signaling to try to reduce some of the danger here.
And the less tweeting.
Less tweeting, indeed.
Thank you guys so much for being here. It's been really, really a pleasure for me, and I hope for all of our listeners out there as well. To our listeners, thanks for joining us, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Yale Journal of International Affairs podcast. Until next time.